new episode of Mac and the Movies. I'm your host, Mackenzie Lambert. This episode, we continue our five-part series on the Grindhouse Experience Volume 1 from Fortune 5 DVD. Last time, we looked at a pair of women in prison films with Women's Camp 119 and Tortured Angels. We also looked at the odd double bill of Mondo documentary Savage Man, Savage Beast, and the kung fu comedy Raw Force. The pair of double bills for this segment include two vigilante films, Confessions of a Police Captain and The Executioner Part 2, and two disaster films, The Poseidon Explosion and Earthquake 7.9. Sounds hopeful, very hopeful. Without further ado, let's get started. Police Captain Bonavia has a vendetta against the local construction industrialist Ferdinando D'Abruzzo. D'Abruzzo has ties with organized crime. Whenever Bonavia starts to have a case to prosecute D'Abruzzo, the case never manages to make it to court. Bonavia is driven to desperate measures. Bonavia arranges the release of a criminally insane inmate who has a previous history with D'Abruzzo. Someone sent word to D'Abruzzo about the inmate's release, avoiding confrontation. Armed with machine guns, the inmate and D'Abruzzo's guards shoot each other down. Brought in to investigate the incident is a young, idealistic deputy district attorney, Trani. During the investigation, Bonavia comes clean to Trani about his frustrations with going after D'Abruzzo. The death of a rebel rouser calling for unionization, the murder of a young boy who was a witness, all of these halted Bonavia's attempts to take out D'Abruzzo. It's at a point where Bonavia suspects those in the criminal justice system of aiding D'Abruzzo. Trani finds it hard to believe. He has faith in the system and the officials that oversee it. He doesn't buy the idea of a conspiracy holding back Bonavia. It turns out the inmate had a sister who was once involved with D'Abruzzo. She knows of his connections with local government officials. Bonavia has her go into hiding at a safe house and informs Trani of her involvement. Will things work out for a change, or will history unfortunately repeat itself? This film is a fantastic police drama pitting vigilanteism against law and order. It's easy to buy into the motivation of Bonavia. It seems as if the laws were made more to protect the criminals more so than the victims. Although we have to keep in mind, these evil deeds are told to us through the narration of Bonavia. This could be a case of an unreliable narrator. Bonavia could be so desperate to take down D'Abruzzo that he may make up incidents that never happened. We already have a scene where Bonavia tells Trani that he's willing to tell blatant lies about Trani.
You fight me with your proof and I'll fight you with slander. And the more incredible, the better.
Don't be ridiculous. What will you accuse me of?
Don't confuse the issues. I said slander.
What slander?
That which you hide from everyone, that your mother is in a Swiss asylum.
What? My mother's worn out. She's just resting.
I know, but I'll say that you're lying, that's all. I'm being accused by a man who has an insane mother. Hereditary insanity. Now, we know a lot about that, don't we, Mr. Traini? And then I'll say that you're a faggot. Take it easy now. Don't lose your temper. That you corrupt minors. You've been seen in the company of a young boy named Pietro Dilly. Isn't that so?
He's an orphan, a child of a...
Oh, I know that. He's the child of a former employee. You're helping him through school. Either you're hard of hearing or you're putting me on. I said slander. I am the first one to admit it. Now, I need slander. Do you know why? Because when they try to prove that I'm wrong, they're going to dig into your cellar and find out that you work for D'Abruzzo. Now, what other vice do you have? Are you hooked on gambling?
Okay, you go to prison for life.
For spreading slander.
No.
Bonavia knows the court of public opinion can be a stronger factor than the actual justice courts. Can we actually trust what Bonavia is telling us? When you think of a grindhouse vigilante film, this is probably the last film you would think of. I don't think this is the kind of film that would keep the rambunctious crowds of 42nd Street interested. A lot of talking, a lot of character development, little to no violence or action. When I think of a vigilante film that would play to the base interests of the grindhouse crowd, I would think of the Polizio Tesci of Enzo G. Castellari, especially The Big Racket. Something more along the lines of Death Wish with Charles Bronson. There was the Bill Lustig film Vigilante with Robert Forster and Fred the Hammer Williamson. Those are more to the liking of the grindhouse crowd. Confessions of a Police Captain by comparison comes off as high art. Director Damiano Damiani offers a straightforward, solid police drama. He handles the material by co-writer Salvatore Larani with the seriousness the film needs. Damiani worked on spaghetti westerns and even the sequel to the Amityville Horror. Cannibal Holocaust composer Riz Ortolani provides a great music score. Ortolani mixes rock sounds with orchestral. Ortolani's approach comes closer to the likes of Stelvio Cipriani and Dave Grusin, more so than that of Morricone. The music score fits the ominous tone of the film's plot. With the exception of a flashback scene with a bad hair dye job, Martin Balsam does a great job as Bonavia. Balsam adds a lot of credibility to this film. He represents classic Hollywood cinema. This man has been in 12 Angry Men, Psycho, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Tora, 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 Little Big Man, and The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. This guy was a big deal when it comes to great American character actors. Franco Nero brings the right degree of naivety to the role of Trani. I have no qualms with admitting my man crush on Franco Nero. He's one of the great cinema badasses. Starting with his breakthrough role in the original Django, he's gone back and forth between Hollywood films and foreign cinema. He was in Django 2, Enter the Ninja, Kioma, Street Law, Lucio Fulci's adaptation of White Fang, High Crime, Die Hard 2, and even the recent John Wick 2. In an interview that Nero did for the supplemental material for Street Law, he mentioned that he believes that laws protect criminals. Knowing that, I'm curious to kind of know if this film convinced him of that perspective, or if he held those principles before production. If it's the latter, then it definitely helped his performance. Two actors that stood out to me in small roles. One is Giancarlo Preet, who plays Giampolo, the one calling for unionization. He's likely best known as Scorpion from the Castellari post-apocalypse film Warriors of the Wasteland. Another actor is Nello Pasafini. He made a career playing thugs in films like Umberto Lenzi's Bloodstained Orchids, Mean Frank and Crazy Tony, Lucio Fulci's crime drama Contraband, and even your Hunter from the Future. But I always think of the Blade Master, a.k.a. Cave Dwellers, and this classic riff from Crow T. Robot.
I'm the best-looking man in the Middle Ages. My, my, my.
While Confessions of a Police Captain may not be the action-heavy, violence-filled police film that would be at home in a grindhouse theater, it is a captivating study of a man resorting to going above the law to take down a criminal. The full movie can be found on YouTube. Highly recommended if you're a fan of crime dramas, a la The Departed or French Connection.
Muggers, rapists, and thugs, beware. Death Wish started it. The Exterminator continued it. The Executioner Part 2 will finish it. He's ready to make their day night. Down in the alley, upon the rooftops, he's watching.
Damn slime.
He's waiting, and he will blow them away. He's coming to a theater near you. Rated R from 21st Century.
Executioner Part 2 opens in 1970 Vietnam, although it looks more like 1984 North Dakota. We see soldiers under assault from Viet Cong gunfire, cut to 1984 Los Angeles. Thugs and criminals are being randomly attacked by an unknown vigilante known as the Executioner. His signature is to kill criminals with hand grenades. Investigating the serial killings is Lieutenant Roger O'Malley and reporter Celia Amherst. The evidence and leads seem to point to O'Malley's friend and fellow soldier, Mike. Mike has had issues with PTSD, often flashbacking to Vietnam and acting in a frenzied manner. Meanwhile, O'Malley's daughter, Laura, is addicted to drugs and is in need of a fix. Her pusher, Pete Vance, offers her a job as a prostitute. Her friend, Kitty, assures her she'll be fine. Listen to this bit of dialogue between Laura and Kitty.
El tren parte a 7 a la mañana para Madrid. Oh, I hate these foreign languages. Oh!
You need one or you won't graduate.
And if I don't graduate, I don't get a decent job. And if I don't get a decent job, oh, Laura, shut up. I hear that shit every day at home from my mother.
Your mother's right.
Screw her. Screw college and screw school. I know better things to do than college and a stupid job.
Please tell me I'm not the only one that wants to kill Kitty. It comes to a point where Mike is face-to-face with the head of the local organized crime. Also, O'Malley must come to terms with the possibility that his friend could be the executioner. Will he be able to fulfill his duty as an officer to arrest him if the time comes? Right off the bat, we need to address the biggest problem with Executioner 2. This is a sequel to a movie that doesn't exist. That's right, there is no Executioner Part 1. Okay, get out your notebooks because this one's going to take a bit of explaining. In 1980, there was a film called The Exterminator, where a Vietnam veteran goes on a vengeance-fueled killing spree with a flamethrower. This movie featured that paper chase guy. In 1984, there was going to be a sequel, Exterminator Part 2. To capitalize on the upcoming film, director James Bryan filmed Executioner Part 2. He specifically used the title Executioner Part 2 in the hopes that audiences will be confused, thinking that this film was a sequel to Exterminator and not realizing Executioner Part 2 was unrelated. Exploitation cinema, folks, right there. Funny side note, the title for this film in Spain was The Executioner of New York. This is despite the fact that the film takes place in Los Angeles. Even foreign distributors fell for Brian's trick. This film, warts and all, is the kind of film that would be praised in the grindhouse environment, much more so than Confessions of a Police Captain. You have the over-the-top acting, the ridiculous melodrama, a lot of violence, and some titillation. This movie isn't great by any measure, but it sure as hell is entertaining, and that's all that mattered to audiences on 42nd Street. The movie doesn't hide its low budget. We get small sets, a few lead actors and some extras. We get stock footage of a police light, the same 4 seconds on a loop. I think all the money went into the North Dakota opening and the helicopter rental. Why not just spend money on more Vietnam stock footage? Director James Bryan gave us this slice of grindhouse after the infamy garnered from his previous film, Don't Go in the Woods. He gave us the biker film, The Hell Riders, starring Adam West. He gave us a pair of lady street fighter movies. Other than these films, he mostly did 80s pornography. Renee Harmon pulled double duty as both the writer of Executioner Part 2 as well as the LA news reporter Celia Amherst. As a writer, Harmon would regularly collaborate with Brian, mostly for his non-pornographic films. As Celia Amherst, she feels like a fish out of water with that thick German accent of hers. She comes off as a low-rent Zsa Zsa Gabor. Christopher Mitchum plays the role of Lieutenant Roger O'Malley. Chris is the son of famed American actor Robert Mitchum, from classics like the original Cape Fear, Night of the Hunter, and Friends of Eddie Coyle. Christopher, on the other hand, was limited to a lot of low-budget fare. His best-known turn would be in the revenge drama Summertime Killer. His only high-profile appearance would be as a ranch hand in the modern western Tombstone. Antoine Jean Motet makes his acting debut as Mike, the suspected vigilante. He really ups the cheesiness of the character and goes gonzo in sequences where Mike is about to go insane. It's like you watch Deer Hunter and wondered if he can go in a more ridiculous direction. Somehow, he succeeded. Motet would only go on to make two more films after this, Bruce Lee's Dragons Fight Back and Arctic Warriors. Not much of a career, to say the least. When one thinks of grindhouse cinema, The Executioner Part 2 is exactly what comes to mind. This is the kind of movie that the likes of Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez try to invoke with their double bill of over-stylized, too self-aware for their own good films. The big difference is that Executioner Part 2 was sincere in its attempt to be the best movie possible, with limited resources available to Brian and company. By doing so, you'll end up enjoying this film as it was meant to be. This one can also be found in its entirety on YouTube.
This is Commander Colleen speaking. Over. Over. Go ahead.
Captain, the engines have had it. The holds are all burning, and no one's alive on the ship. Looks pretty serious.
Over to you, sir.
Hold one is loaded with these tanks. They look like oxygen tanks. If they explode, we're done for, Captain. Tell our men to get the fire brigade out here, because if those tanks catch fire, we've all had it. Over to you, sir.
This is Colleen speaking.
What's wrong?
Sir, we're on the Poseidon. All of the ship's holds are burning now.
True.
There's nobody alive in the whole ship.
Any danger of explosion?
The number one hold is loaded with oxygen tanks, and I'm afraid the fire's getting really close, sir. Have the fire brigade come out right away.
You sure there are no survivors?
Yes, I'm sure. All the men are dead, sir.
Any lifeboats out?
No.
Pumps working?
No. Please send the fire brigade, sir. I'll do what I can.
The Poseidon explosion centers on a life-or-death situation where a ship carrying a cargo of oxygen tanks and tons of ammonium nitrate is on fire. The ship is first boarded by two captains who survey the situation and radio a report. Soon, a wedding party passes by and a few men join the captains to help. Word is called in to the fire brigade, but the terrain and location of the boat prevent their aid within a timely manner. Within hours, word has spread to the workers at the docks nearby. While being instructed to vacate the premises and go back home, they revolt and swim towards the boat to assist in any way they can. They arrive and begin to unload as much of the ammonium nitrate as possible in the hope of mitigating the damage caused by an explosion that could happen at any minute. Meanwhile, you have the mayor, Corbea, consulting with his colleagues on what to do about this ship. If the contents cannot be unloaded in time, or if the fire extinguishing efforts prove futile, then the ship will explode. Is there a possible location where the ship can be detonated with minimal casualties and less collateral damage? The Poseidon explosion is based on a true story. Like, seriously, it is. A Panamanian vessel loaded with ammonium nitrate threatened to explode and destroy the Romanian cities of Galati and Brăila. This is one of those rare circumstances where based on a true story is not a load of baloney or an attempt to make a few extra bucks on consumer gullibility. I'm looking right at you, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. On a side note, I've seen a few people online mistakenly label this film as Italian, since many of the English ADR actors working on the dubbing also did so for many Italian films for directors like Lucio Fulci and Dario Argento. The film tells a great tale of people willing to put their lives at stake in order to save their fellow man. There is a true sense of altruism among the cast. The film manages to maintain a serious tone throughout the scenario. Granted, there are a few moments of comedy which bring some much-needed levity. One of the heroes is a violinist, and for the film not to make the easy joke reference to Emperor Nero and Burning Rome is a sigh of relief. There's a segment where looters board the boat and the heroes dispatch them in comedic fashion. The pacing is great, with the film establishing the threat right from the very beginning and carrying that constant sense of danger all the way through till the end. Film editor Dragos Witkowski earns a tip of the hat by keeping the film in as close a real time as possible. In the last 20 minutes, the escalation is established. The temperature is rising 2 degrees a minute. At that point, the temperature is at 260 degrees. If the temperature reaches 300, the cargo will explode, in addition to the frequent busting of fuel lines on the ship. That 20-minute countdown begins at the starting point of the last 20 minutes of the movie. I was already invested in the film at that point, and the real-time countdown furthered my investment. While the title was clearly an attempt to cash in on the name recognition of the 1972 film Poseidon Adventure with Gene Hackman and Ernest Borgnine, Poseidon Explosion tells an interesting story all of its own, and it manages to maintain a steady pace in an hour and 20 minutes. According to the IMDb, the runtime is 1 hour and 52 minutes. I'm guessing Fortune 5 DVD used the US edit instead of the original Romanian edit. And you know what? I am totally okay with that. I could imagine that if they had included that extra half hour, I would be checking my phone. But the missing half hour makes for a more invigorating viewing experience. Director Mircea Dragan passed away just last year on Halloween. Looking at his directorial credits, I'm curious to see what other gems may be hidden in his filmography, and if they compare to the surprising quality of Poseidon Explosion. Writer Ion Grigorescu manages to keep the film's feet on the ground. He doesn't rely on extreme circumstances or making the situation so unbelievable that the solution to solve the problem doesn't come off as believable, if that makes sense. He tells a believable story, well-paced and filled with interesting characters. The music by Theodore Grigoriou wasn't memorable. It wasn't wall-to-wall sound, but used to accent the sense of danger in certain sequences. The cast features some great acting talents that take the material seriously, which is the key for the audience taking the film seriously. George Dinica, as the lead Raphael, is a great everyman hero. He has a bit of a charm and an unbreakable sense of optimism. Comedian Jean Constantine plays the violinist I mentioned previously, and he plays a key part in some of the lighthearted moments. Toma Karagu plays the mayor, and he doesn't play the role in a manner like so many others play that character in these films. Usually the mayor tries to ignore the imminent danger. Take your pick. Jaws, Ghostbusters, any number of films where those in position of power brush off the danger. But Karagu's performance reminded me of Peter Sellers as President Muffley in Dr. Strangelove. Muffley was one of the few characters taking the doomsday situation presented in that dark comedy satire seriously. Karagu does the same here as the mayor. Dem Radulescu plays one of the captains that first discovers the burning ship. He has similar physical features to Ernest Borgnine, which isn't a surprise. If one uses Poseidon in the film's title, then using actors similar in appearance to the mainstream talent in that film is a given. Radu Beligan plays the chemist who is trying to use science and physics to lengthen the timetable before the explosion. Similar to Karagu, Beligan handles the scenario with the needed seriousness. Don't let the exploitative title or the fact that this production is Romanian in origin fool you. This is a pretty good movie. Good performances, great pacing, and a scenario that escalates the tension through the film's entire running time. This one is also available on YouTube. Seismologist Yoichi Kwazu predicts an earthquake that will strike Tokyo. It has been around a decade since the last earthquake struck the city. Yoichi believes the earthquake will be the most devastating ever experienced. He is the son of a seismologist that predicted the worst earthquake in the city's history at the time, back in 1923. Sadly, his prediction falls on deaf ears. His superiors don't believe him and think he's just trying to boost his profile. His own family distances themselves and frequently bring up the shame his foolish prediction has placed upon them. Then the earthquake hits and all hell breaks loose. 57 minutes into the film, the earthquake strikes. The film becomes a special effects showcase, mixing practical sets with quick shots of miniatures. I'm sorry, but when I see Japanese cities being destroyed, I'm waiting for the guy in a rubber monster suit to show up. Or maybe invisible kaiju. You know what? Invisible kaiju I've never seen before in a film. Forget the earthquake nonsense. Pretend the city in this film is being attacked by invisible monsters. Now the movie seems a whole lot better. We get some pretty messed up imagery. One guy gets crushed when the ground cracks open under him, and then he falls in, but the ground closes back in on him. A subway tunnel is flooded, with the few survivors surrounded by drowned bodies. People are falling to their death from an apartment building. In the time leading up to the disaster, there is some soap opera melodrama. Yoichi is having an affair and his wife wants a divorce. More so because of the shame he brought with his earthquake prediction and not because of his infidelity. This drags the film down. It feels like padding for the 97-minute runtime. The film can be found under a slew of different titles. The Grindhouse Experience cover lists the film as Earthquake 7.9. Other titles include Deathquake and Megaforce 7.9. Much like Poseidon Explosion, this film on the IMDb is listed as over 2 hours. Fortune 5 DVD gives us a 97-minute cut. I couldn't sit through the full length, and neither would 42nd Street audiences at the time. Not even the theaters would use this edit. They need quick edits so that they could cram in as many showings as possible. Now, the logic of the authorities in this family, I have a hard time believing that. It's not like a seismologist earns credibility by making claims that turn out to be false. And the film establishes no prior history of Yoichi making false predictions of earthquakes. For the authorities and his family to suddenly not believe him is shaky to say the least. Seismology, from what I can tell, is a profession that does not allow for the margin of error we would expect for, say, weathermen. If a weatherman predicts sunshine but we get rain, worst case scenario is mild inconvenience. The worst that can happen is we get a little bit soaked. Seismology, on the other hand, I would think it's best to give them the benefit of the doubt. If they have the readings and the data to show something is on the horizon, believing them is for the best. If nothing happens, at least you took the proper precautions. If you believe them and something happens, then you've at least mitigated the damage. If you don't believe them and the crap hits the fan, then you get exactly what happens in this movie. You get an absolutely awesome disaster sequence that would bring a tear to the eyes of Michael Bay and Zack Snyder. This film was destruction porn before destruction porn was a thing. The film does a great job of illustrating the pressures placed upon generations of Japanese families of nobility. Yoichi's father was a hero for his 1923 prediction. That same expectation for efficiency falls on the shoulders of Yoichi. Yet, when Yoichi is put up to the task, his expectations are flipped on him. Now people are telling him to be quiet. If you want a better film to illustrate this cultural element, go check out the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi. I really can't comment on the performances due to the contrast of dubbing with Japanese acting. The music by Toshiaki Tsushima amps up the melodrama, but is minimal during the disaster sequences. The sound recordist, Kenshiro Hayashi, uses the sound effects to create a symphony of destruction. His sound editing is the co-star to Teruyoshi Nakano's special effects direction for the earthquake sequences. To wrap up this review, Earthquake 7.9 starts out slow, but when the build disaster strikes, you're in for a pretty good time. This is one of the few films that you can't find on YouTube, but those of you who are internet savvy, I'm sure can find it pretty easily. We're 8 films into the first volume of the Grindhouse Experience. I'm actually going to go ahead and rank those 8 at the moment. At the bottom, we have Tortured Angels. Not that much more ahead would be Women's Camp 119. Number 6 would be Savage Man's Savage Beast. I would put Earthquake 7.9 at number 5. Executioner Part 2, I would rank at number 4. Number 3 would be the Poseidon Explosion. Raw Force would be number 2. And then number 1, I would put Confessions of a Police Captain. Things have gotten a lot better this time around with this batch of films. I don't really have much as far as a post-amble goes for this episode, just a few minor things. I had the chance to try out Mafia 3 on the PS4, one of the free PS Plus games for August. It was the first open-world crime game I've enjoyed since Grand Theft Auto Vice City, back on the PS2. And no, I don't consider Red Dead Redemption an open-world crime game, since the plot has Marston taking down his former criminal associates on behalf of the government. Mafia 3 takes place in the exotic setting of the New Orleans-inspired city, New Bordeaux, in 1968. You play as Lincoln Clay, a Vietnam veteran who survives a mob hit. With other wronged associates, you take down the mobster that left you for dead. We have great characters, a nice array of weapons. I personally prefer the combo of the AK-47 with the Elmwood 1925 shotgun. Once you get the remote explosive upgrade for the Screaming Zemi, the game becomes a cakewalk. There's also some nice looking rides. Best of all is the soundscape, which is full of period-appropriate classics. The Beach Boys, Elvis Presley, Eric Burdon and the Animals, Johnny Cash, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Sam Cooke, Rolling Stones, Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding, some of my favorites. The one aspect of the soundtrack that breaks the immersion is the inclusion of covers of some of these songs by bands not part of the period. I mean, I love the Ramones, but they don't belong in this game. Joe Bob Briggs and Shudder have finally shared more details on the next Marathon specials. That's right, specials, as in more than one. There will be a Thanksgiving special, The Dinners of Death, and a Christmas special, A Very Joe Bob Christmas. Dinners of Death is scheduled for Thanksgiving Day, while A Very Joe Bob Christmas is set for Friday, December 21st. Most exciting of all for me are the plans for an actual MonsterVision-type series hosted by Joe Bob on Shudder. The details will be announced in early 2019. As someone who grew up on MonsterVision on TNT, I am very, very happy about this news. And we come to a close on this episode for the Grindhouse Experience Volume 1. Thanks for taking time out of your day to give this a listen. Next time, we have a pair of crime movies. Violent professionals build with Mean Frank and Crazy Tony. Plus, we have two martial arts chop sake style films, Kung Fu Punch of Death and Return of the Tiger. Another batch that sounds promising. That episode should go up on, let's see, that'll be Friday, September 21st. If you enjoy this content, feel free to follow me on social media and follow this podcast on the platform of your choice. I'm on Podomatic, Google Music, Spotify, iTunes. I have a Facebook page and Twitter as well. If you'd like to see the program grow, consider supporting my Patreon. $1 a month will net you a special thanks credit. $3 a month will allow you to contribute to the creative direction of Meg and the Movies. If you prefer a one-time donation, I have a PayPal as well. A $5 donation will net you a credit as a movie review sponsor. Links for everything in the description. I'm Mackenzie Lambert with Mac and the Movies. Until next time, take care, everyone.